Okay, great.
There you go.
Thanks.
All right, you just did 217.
Yeah.
So we only have four people right now, but it doesn't matter. More people will definitely come in as we go on. They're usually running. And
the virtual
like
people won't get the pizza.
That's right. It's their loss. We usually have good pizza. So today's talk is going to be from Daniel Rubin, who is in the Stanford Center for Biomedical Informatics Research, formerly SMI. I've known Daniel since I've been here for 3 years, but Daniel's been here for a long time. So you did your undergrad here as well, right? Undergrad, med school, and residency.
Everything possible.
Residency and master's training in medical informatics. So at Harvard, we used to call folks like this Preparation H. So I guess this would be Preparation S. slight intended there. But you need a name for that. So
okay.
you would qualify. So Daniel's work is really in radiology informatics, more than really image processing. But what do you do with these diagnoses of these images? Can we use these images for other types of analytical or interpretive approaches, especially connecting them back to the molecular side? I'm sure he's going to be talking about his future research directions as he starts to stabilize his future
Thank you.
Plans.
Thank you very much, Atul, and thanks for inviting me. And it's a pleasure to be here to talk about this aspect of informatics. I'm going to be talking about informatics in the imaging domain, and in addition to talking to the work I'm doing, I'm going to talk about a little bit of the overall field so you get a good sense, because since I understand you're all doing scholarly concentrations, is that right? So it would be beneficial for you to get as broad a view of what the field is about. And, well, imaging informatics is driven by the fact that we produce images, you know, and images are actually pervasive not only in medical diagnosis, but actually in biological practice. I mean, even Atul deals with images, although he does a lot of microarray work. But images are one of the fundamental data types, but they're more complex than the average data type because it's not simply a measurement, a number. An image is at least a two-dimensional and sometimes a three-dimensional data structure that is an abstract representation of some entity that exists in our biomedical reality. So there's something here which is an object that is in the real world, a biological element like a cell or might be a person. And then there is some imaging device, some system, that is going to use some property of physics to produce a mathematical representation of what that object looks like or what that object is doing biologically. So it isn't necessarily only about morphologic appearance. It could be about what kinds of function is going on. And the output of that process is an image. Now, most people think imaging and informatics is all about this process, and that is a component, but once you produce a data structure, there's a lot of elements of analysis that need to come in, and I'll be talking about some of that as well as the image formation aspect. But if we take a 20,000-foot view, and I want to put all of imaging informatics on one slide, it's about a few things. It's about the first element of how do you generate the image to begin with, and so that means what are the physical principles or the imaging modalities that can be used to interact with the substance, the biological substance, the person or the cell to produce that image in the first place. Then once you produce the image, what are the computer methods for processing it? I remember, as I showed you, you get a two-dimensional or three-dimensional structure. There are various image processing methods that will be applied to yield some of the latent biomedical content in that image. And then a human being ultimately is one of the consumers of images, and it's important for a person to see the image in a way that highlights the biomedical meaning of the object that was originally imaged, and that brings up a dimension of visualization. Another aspect is a radiologist is one particular large consumer, somebody who will make medical diagnoses by looking at the image with their human eyes, and that involves a series of image detection tasks and what we'll call interpretation or diagnosis. What is going on with the patient? And finally, there's getting the computer involved in doing that same process, looking at the image and instead of the human being, having the computer look at it and make some interpretations or inferences, and that's reasoning, computer reasoning or image-based computer reasoning. So I'm going to be hitting briefly on this huge swath of topics to give you a survey of the field, starting with a quick overview of what these modalities are, because when you say imaging, what are we talking about? Well, in radiology, just virtually every aspect of physics is being used to make image. If you can just think of one aspect of the electromagnetic spectrum, I don't think radiology has missed any element, except microwaves per se, of the EM spectrum shown here, going from high energy all the way down to low energy. And I've thrown sound in, that's technically not EM, but I'm going to That's one other type of physical principle for producing images. But you use these radiation sources, or sound sources, or light sources, or gamma rays, to produce images, and the modalities fall directly out of that. If you're using X-rays, then we're going to produce radiographs, or X-rays, as they're more colloquially called. Computed tomography is also a dominant modality that uses that spectrum of the EM. Then gamma rays and particles are used dominantly in a set of modalities referred to collectively as nuclear medicine and molecular imaging, depending on whether you're imaging the whole person or something at the lower scale, at the molecule or cellular scale. And positron emission tomography, PET, as you might have heard, is a specific type of nuclear medicine technology that is commonly used in clinical diagnosis. On the light side, optical imaging is being increasingly used. Actually, it was a very important paper came out in PANS using light for imaging using Raman scattering principles that looks promising for imaging superficial tumors, tumors that when you irradiate with laser beam the surface of a tissue, you can see a small superficial tumor under the surface. Sound is used in ultrasound. The ultrasonic range is the higher spectral range of sound. You can't hear it, but it penetrates tissue, it gets reflected, and is used to create images. And finally, radio waves are the basic wave for magnetic resonance imaging, MRI. So those are all of our modalities based on the physical principles. What do they look like? Well, before I show you the pictures, let's lay them out on a grid. One dimension is the spatial resolution. You know, of all those modalities, how are they different? Well, they differ in two dimensions. One is how high a resolution do you see of spatial information, so we'll lay it on that dimension. And the other aspect is the modality tell you something about the tissue function. They all tell you something about morphology, shape, you know, like a camera taking a picture of a person. But some modalities tell you more functional biological information than others. So then we lay them out along those two dimensions. You can see that radiography, the X-rays, because of high photon flux, produces very high resolution images, very good anatomical detail, not so much functional information because it's all based on absorption of the X-rays. CT, computed tomography, will be similar, and ultrasound also similar. But as you move across to MRI and PET and PET CT, we're now exploiting the targeting capability of small molecules because we inject substances into people and the radiation comes out, so we can produce images that are based more on the functional aspect of the tissues. And oftentimes the trade-off is you lose some spatial resolution because you can't put a huge amount of radiation into a person and produce a high spatial resolved image because you don't want to, you know, kill the patient in the process of imaging their biology. So these images tend to be noisier, and that's by virtue of just how much radiation you can put into a person. But the advantage is we get more functional information. So think about, when you think about all those modalities, those are the two dimensions of information that that you generally want to think about them in terms, and that's why we have all these different modalities, because they give different types of information about different things, either anatomy or function. So that's the modalities and producing the image. Now let's get into, and there is a lot of informatics in terms of producing that technologically, but I want to focus on when you produce the image, how does the computer help us work with the product of those modalities, the images themselves. And I'll start by talking about the fundamental image processing and visualization methods. This is a dominant chunk of the field that's called imaging informatics. And the key thing is we're going to take these images, which are two-dimensional arrays of numbers, and we're going to subject that array to a number of different types of mathematical operations to enhance them or to do something that will help them be more useful to the people who look at them, whether it's a biologist or a clinician. So that's the data structure. Each image is a 2D matrix of numbers, an example image shown here, and if you magnify any image, you can actually see each little square is just basically a representation of the number displayed on some level of grayscale where high or low will either be high or low intensity will correspond to a large or small number. It's as simple as that. And color is a function of whether you have one number in a cell or three. Three numbers would be RGB. How we process images? Well, generally there's a pipeline. We generally have a bunch of methods that we string together, take the image, shove it in, and subject it to a series of operations that make it a more useful data structure to work with, or produce highlights particular aspects of information that will be useful to the radiologist or the biologist who looks at the image, starting with the acquisition. So we produce an array of pixels. And generally, the first thing that's done to an image is a segmentation, dividing up the image into regions of interest, which I'll talk about, producing some sort of two-dimensional or three-dimensional rendering or visualization, then taking images from, let's say, two or three or four modalities and fusing them all together so that you can kind of get a simultaneous look at anatomy and physiology or function, kind of the best of both worlds by fusing different modalities of images together. Maybe then having a computer look at the image and figure out, is there an abnormality? And I'll be talking about the CAD type approaches. And then finally, a human being also looking at the image and producing a report to a referring clinician, in the case of radiology, what are the abnormalities, what should happen to the patient. So what are the image processing methods? Well, a whole grab bag of techniques, all basically transformations or mathematical operations on these two-dimensional or three-dimensional image matrices. And the methods I'll just talk about briefly to give you a flavor are histogram equalization, convolution filtering, segmentation, and there are a whole host of others. And they're all basically geared toward enhancing some particular element of information in the image itself. So a histogram equalization, what is that? Well, if you take a look at this image on the left and you just look at it visually and you say, yeah, it's kind of not a pretty image. I mean, it's very fuzzy. I see a lot of black and I see a lot of white, and I can't really see a lot of other detail, and it doesn't look very contrasty. If you took every pixel value and put it on a histogram, you'd see that there's a lot of black and there's a lot of white and there's not a lot in between. You can renormalize the matrix because, as I said, each number is mapped to a gray level. You can equalize the distribution of lights and darks in an image to that array of numbers and just simply display the image so that there's equal representations of the very dark and the very light and the in between. And that's called histogram equalization because we're equalizing the histogram of grays across the image. We haven't changed the underlying raw numbers. We've just changed what gray level gets mapped to each number. And by doing that, you look at the image and it looks more pleasing. You can see more intermediate grays. You can see some more detail in this part of the lung. You also, by the way, see there are actual streak lines, artifacts on this image, which were hard to appreciate in the original image. So this is an example of a very simple mathematical transformation on the display side of the image to enhance its appearance, the ability of a viewer to look at the image. Another common method is convolution. Now, this is a method where we're going to change the actual pixel values in the image. And as an example of this, instead of a big 2D image, let's just take a single vector, you know, a row of numbers, say that's a piece of an image. And you can see that we've got some threes followed by sixes. So let's say our goal, you know, the general goal of convolution is to apply a mathematical operation to every pixel in the image to accomplish some enhancement to the image itself. A mean filter is a common convolution, and what this is going to do is it's going to reduce the overall variation in intensity across the image to smooth it out. If you look at this input image, you can see we have a lot of threes and then a sudden jump to sixes. So there's a very sharp contrast that occurs right here at this spatial point in the image. If you apply a convolution, when I say convolution, what it means is you apply a kernel. This is a kernel, one-third, 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 and you simply do a multiplication across this matrix, and the way that's done is you move this matrix up here and you apply one-third times three, one-third times three, one-third times three, and you sum those up and we generate, and then we slide it across the whole matrix and we'll generate a new image, an output image, and you'll now notice the output of that is we still have highs and lows, but notice we have a slow transition, so that is smoothing out the transition in sharp contrast boundaries. Similarly, here's another filter called the Laplace filter. This is now going to do the opposite. This is going to try and enhance the boundary between highs and lows. It uses just a different kernel, slide it across. Notice we've gone from 0 to 3 to suddenly negative 3 and zeros. We're going to very sharply enhance the margin of the image, the contrast. What does that look like? So here we've taken a kernel. Now this time we've taken a three-dimensional kernel, but applied it across the whole image. And notice how we've gone from a pretty sharp image to a smoothed out image, and that's very advantageous if you kind of want to reduce the noise, apparent noise in the image. I remember in that histogram equalized image, you know, if I had an image like this and I wanted to hide this, kind of smooth that out, I would use that that median filter to smooth out that noise. The high pass filtering, you know, enhance the edges, that's a very common method for trying to segment or divide up an image into regions. If you apply a high pass filter to these two input images, if it's a high pass enough, you can get to the point that we're outlining the structures or the boundaries in the image, and we can kind of use that as a segmentation mechanism. This is actually the basis of cell segmentation in biology, one of the methods to try and go from the raw image to identifying closed structures that represent the objects or the components in the image themselves. So that's lead into segmentation. The concept there is you've got an image, you look at it, you know, the human being looking at the image knows, you know, there's different kinds of flowers in different parts of this garden, and there's trees. We'd like to divide this image up because there are a lot of biomedical applications where you'll want to do a measurement. How many roses are here? Or is it growing? Or is the garden doing well? And those are all based on analyzing components of the image. So segmentation is commonly a very important first step to any kind of an image processing ultimate application, because you're going to always want to identify or put a label, also called semantics, on a particular component of the image. The commonest way of doing segmentation is manually, drawing a margin. But if you want to do this for lots of images, you're going to need computer methods. So segmentation is generally referred to as the automated process of doing that. And I mentioned it's very tightly connected to this notion of semantics or content. What is in the image? When you look at the image, you say, well, there's a person there and there's a table. Segmentation, when it's applied, divides up the image into different regions. This particular segmentation took out the whole person. This particular segmentation divided up the person into the head and this part of the clothing, et cetera, and then puts labels on them that have some particular meaning. So that's what segmentation's about, and it's useful because then imagine we wanted to process a bunch of images and get a sense for, well, how different are head sizes or shapes? Are they all oval? Are they all certain volume or size? We could calculate that only after we have the segmentation of the images accomplished. Now, as I said, it's normally a manual process. Now imagine you just had 1,000 images going through a human being. You know, do this by hand. That's what the saying is. It's a very laborious and time-consuming process. And there's a lot of work being done to automate the process. In an automated segmentation, a computer takes the original image and uses a variety of methods. It might use the high-pass filter I mentioned before. It might do edge detection. It might do look for particular densities in the original source image and produce a new image from the source image that puts the intensity value based on the structure or the component of the segmentation. So here, the output segmentation image is labeled in green every pixel element that the algorithm thought would be lung, and it made in blue every element that it thought was going to be a vascular structure in the right lung. It didn't do that in the left lung. It highlighted in this color all the muscles, and black all the bones, and in blue all the skin elements. And you can imagine if you had a large number of images, you can then start doing quantitation based on those segmented features. So I want to talk briefly about some of the next part of the pipeline is, well, if you had segmentation, an image is segmented, how would that be useful? What would be the other processing or applications that would be consumers of that? And the most important one that you see medically is model building. You'll take a series of contiguous or adjacent cross-sectional slices of a human being produced by, for example, a CT or MRI, segment it using a manual or semi-automated method, and then build a three-dimensional representation of that structure, because that will be much easier to get a sense of the three-dimensional relationships than looking at the raw two-dimensional images. The visible human, which is freely available and downloadable at the National Library of Medicine, is the basis of some of the images I'll show you next. It has been segmented by semi-automated methods and then subjected to a variety of algorithms to produce, for example, a surface rendering of the cadaver that was the subject of the visible human. So what they did at the National Library of Medicine is take this person who was deceased, and they sliced him into 1-millimeter sections and took photographs. And what you're seeing over here, these two quadrants are the photograph of a cross-sectional slice through the heart region. Here's heart. These two quadrants show an automated segmentation algorithm that recognized the cardiac chambers, shown in these different colors, recognized part of the aorta and lungs, all labeled with a different color but mapped to a lexicon that says this part of the image is lung, this part is the supraspinatus muscle, etc. So you've produced an atlas from the visible human, and that can be used in generating three-dimensional geographic models, such as of the heart. So this is a three-dimensional rendering of the heart from the visible human data set, and it's highlighting here the part of the left ventricle, the outer surface of the left ventricle, and then this can be then subjected either to a pretty visualization with a rotating display, or we could start doing things like a volume measurement, shape measurements, other types of measurements from that model. Of course, it's basis of pretty pictures. Here was visible human segmented, and then each rib is unlabeled here, but here each numbered rib was labeled with a different color, as well as the costophrenic junctions, which were identified and then highlighted with different colors. So we've segmented not only the ribs, but the cartilage and the junctions, and can present that as a volumetric colored display. So the other reason is that doing segmentations, besides just producing 3D pretty visualizations, is important is to actually create what we call atlases, maps that can be used to take a clinical data set and help a clinician understand where in the brain is a particular abnormality. So fMRI is one type of magnetic resonance imaging that produces, you know, bright and dark spots of different colors according to the flow going to the brain under circumstances of activation of particular parts of the brain from a stimulus. And the first thing a researcher will do when they get an fMRI is they'll want to understand, well, there's some interesting activity going in these parts of the brain. What parts of the brain are those? So you will generally, if you don't have an atlas in front of you, you'll kind of use your memory. Or if you have an atlas, you'll try and find a comparable slice and say, is this about here? That's a very painstaking, manual type of process of figuring out what is the spatial location of each area of an image. So people are creating, particularly for the brain, standard atlases that are pre-segmented and labeled with each anatomical structure. So over here is shown an atlas image from one of those brain atlases. And each color, this is occipital cortex highlighted here, and different structures, you know, thalami, and here are the caudate nuclei. So each is a different color, different geometric structure in the brain. And then it's simply a matter of doing a registration of a patient's data set to the atlas. There's some deformation that's involved to match perfectly corresponding structures. But when you find the same level in the atlas, you register the unknown data set to the atlas, and then you can localize what is the regions that correspond to the particular areas of interest in the image. And so that process is called automatic image labeling. And you can imagine then doing this in a large scale. Is there a question? Yeah. If there is, would you lose? I'm not sure if I understand. So, in other words, in the process, are you concerned that the process of doing the registration loses information?
Yeah.
Or, well, what's the mapping and registration process is basically the same process a human being does. In other words, two answers to your question. Pragmatically, does a surgeon take the output of a computer and blindly operate without double checking by eye? Do they agree with what the system is telling them? I would certainly hope not. The goal of anything that what I'm talking about, these informatics methods, is to enhance or inform somebody of alternative possibilities they might not have considered. If it blatantly makes a mistake, well, first of all, the process of doing that deformable registration to the brain, the deformations in the case of the brain are so slight that, at least in the brain, this approach, it's called affine registration, is correct. It doesn't make mistakes, and it will produce the same answer as a human being when they also use an atlas to figure out what structure is it. Now, pragmatically, a neurosurgeon, if they're going to take a structure out, they put probes in to figure out, is that going to excite the leg? Because you can't say with 100% certainty, is that for sure that region? Because it's based on a canonical atlas, which may or may not be applicable to every individual person. You know, there could be an anatomical variation, so you could be off a little bit. So pragmatically speaking, you wouldn't take the result of this and say, we're going to operate because we think that's that. You're going to double-check it in that person. The way this is used mostly is to help process large volumes of data and ask the question, in a population of people, if we studied 5,000 patients with Alzheimer's disease, does this pattern light up in the occipital lobe? You can answer that question in an automated way without having to do that by hand. So that's the goal of it. Another example of using a segmentation and model, three-dimensional model, is to start answering questions, like querying the image. Let's suppose a person was in the ER, they had been stabbed by some projectile or been shot, and the projectile had a particular path. You saw the entry wound and the exit wound. Could you figure out, before you went through every slice of the CT, what structure was in that trajectory? Well, the answer is you could. Similar process, build a three-dimensional model, intersect the path, and query what is every structure at every point along that path based on querying the model for spatial localization of organs. And so this is the list of organs that are transected, anatomic structures, by that model. You see it hit the left ventricle, left atrium, et cetera. So the other thing that we do with these segmented volume sets is produce visualizations for human consumption, not for computer consumption, just produce pretty pictures. And these are often very useful to surgeons in guiding surgery because they'll want to rotate in three dimensions to get a sense for what is related to what in 3D space. And there are many ways of producing these. How are they produced? They're produced by taking the series of axial stacked slices and processing that three-dimensional matrix different ways. We can take that three-dimensional matrix of pixel values and do what's called a maximum intensity projection. I'll be showing you that. Or we can take curved or flat planes through different angles of that volume. It all becomes a matter of how do we slice and dice a three-dimensional volume of pixel elements to present on a two-dimensional or rotating type of display. And the third method I'll talk about is volume and surface rendering. So the simplest way of viewing a stacked set of slices is just lay them out in rows, and in the old days, that's how radiologists would look at the slices that came out of a CT or MRI scanner is just a series, and they'd kind of, all have nystagmus looking back and forth and building up a picture in three dimensions. We don't do that anymore. We kind of take the image stack of images. So here's our two-dimensional image, and we take a whole stack of them, which goes through the whole body, and we will do different processing on them. The first one I'll talk about is maximum intensity projection. What that is you take and you cast rays through this volume, and you cast it according to the direction that the eye is looking at the volume. So as shown here, if the eye has this perspective on the volume, we cast rays that correspond to the angles the eye views the image through the volume, and we take the maximum. So if this ray goes through this set of pixel values and the maximum value through that ray is 8, then that's at that point of the image right here, we plot an 8, et cetera, so that we produce a two-dimensional image that's a projection from a maximum intensity projection across the image, display that, and guess what? The raw volume was the grayscale image of the patient. The maximum intensity projection is showing us the very bright structures in the body. In a contrast-enhanced CT, the bright structures are the arteries. So this is a common technique of producing a CT angiogram. That highlights the contrast in the blood vessels at the point of time of acquisition when the contrast agent in the blood was high intensity. It's commonly used for example, pulmonary angiography. So if you're on your surgical rotation or medical rotation, you have a patient with PE, you might ask for a CT pulmonary angiogram, and you'll get images like this, which are maximum intensity projection images. Actually, I think these days they're even prettier than this example. And this is the main pulmonary artery and left and right pulmonary artery. And you would be looking for filling defects. But these are produced by that ray casting of maximum intensities across that volume. Well, yeah?
Is that ray casting done on sort of targeted to, like in this case, we're targeted to, around the mediastinum and like around that point?
You generally get a whole series of them because what it comes down to is the software lets you produce a whole series of different 3D or 2D renderings based on what you want to do. So if you wanted to look at this in different perspectives, you would rotate the volume in the software and do the ray casting. So this was basically like an anterior-posterior ray cast. Then if I wanted to turn the patient and repeat it, you get a whole series of these. And that's generally what happens. And I could, this is laying the patient out like this. I might want to tilt it like that. Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
Time. Yes.
Because I guess I'm just surprised that the maximum intensity gives you results like that.
Yes.
What it becomes
a matter of is, well, what are the maximum intensities in radiography? Radiography is a function of X radiation being absorbed by dense structures. The densest thing in the body is bone. So clearly, now bone's been subtracted here. So that's one little detail I left out. But the other thing is, so that's why you don't see the spine. And the way you can subtract that is segmentation. That's what was done here, because you say, well, bone is subtracted out, but why do I see calcium? This is the bright stuff's calcium. It's because actually it wasn't simply thresholding, you know, take everything below a certain value to get rid of the bones. It was done by actually editing the volume, you know, and by drawing or manually or automatically pull out the spine, now do the ray casting, and you produce a picture like that. Because you're right, if you just take a, that's why you chain these processing steps together, because just a pure ray casting won't give you as satisfying a result as segmentation followed by ray casting, and that's why you chain pipeline image processing together. I mentioned multiplanar and curved planar display. So we take that image volume and we're going to slice and dice it differently. You know, we'll take the volume, and let's suppose we take an oblique slice. You know, we'll just take a slice through some oblique plane. Then we can do things like this, where we take a coronal slice that's tilted through the liver so that we can see the common bile duct. So the common bile duct's kind of running through like this, and this arrow is pointing out that there is some calcification, a stone in the common bile duct, and that's often just a nicer way of laying out the abnormality and helping a radiologist or a surgeon figure out, is that thing really where I think it is anatomically? And that's how curved reformations are used. And then it can get even more fancy in terms of making any arbitrarily shaped plane. If you've got a tortuous structure like the aorta and you want it, or the pancreas, and you want it to just fillet out the pancreas very nicely, you could do that by drawing a curved plane. So here in this example, we took the axial slice and drew a curved plane that is, you know, something not as squiggly as this, but lays out what we're displaying here now is a warped coronal slice that's laying out the pancreatic duct. And similarly, this very tortuous plane is laying out very nicely a very normally tortuous aorta that's coming down and bifurcating into the iliac arteries. And it's just another way of slicing the data set to show a visualization that's appealing to the surgeon and helps them figure out, you know, how big things are, where the abnormalities are. Now, probably the commonest technique for doing visualization is what's called volume rendering. And this is done by making a special table, a computational structure from the original 3D data set that maps the original raw data to a set of display intensities that have different amounts of transparency or opaqueness based on and color scale based on the composition of the tissue. And you'll see pictures like this, which are almost kind of shockingly anatomic, because those renderings include things like light reflection, you know, perspective, et cetera. And you can produce, you know, any sort of arbitrary type of phenomenon like, well, what if we drilled a hole and looked inside the vessels? I mean, people are getting artistically very creative with their three-dimensional visualizations using this volume rendering technique. And this is the commonest method of actually viewing preoperative radiological imaging. So, for example, the commonest reason to use volume displays, volume rendering, is to lay out and display the arteries, color them, and you can show to the surgeon, you know, where is their narrowing, a little bit of narrowing, what is the caliber of the aorta, what is connected to what. And these are, you know, almost near netter anatomic type of drawings. You know, I said here, the ultimate Gray's anatomy. So this is almost becoming like a toy. It's actually some of this technology is used in modern games. So there is some good medical application for this besides just showing pretty pictures to people or to the surgeons for surgical planning. There's a new technique which you might have heard about. It's actually now primed to become an alternative to optic colonoscopy called virtual colonoscopy, where we do a volumetric CT set of the abdomen to include the colon, and then take and calculate the median axis of the colon and produce what is in essence a virtual tour, endoscopic tour of the mucosal surface of the colon, calculated purely from traversing this data set in this case, you know, the medial axis of the colon, and producing a surface rendering of the surface of the colon. And then David Peck, who's a faculty member in radiology here, did this fancy thing of mathematically straightening out the colon and then filleting it open like a virtual autopsy to give people a one-shot look of where is a tumor in the colon, what's this mucosal surface look like, purely done by mathematical operations on that three-dimensional data set. Is there a question? Yeah.
Do you
Yes, and it's accurate. So there's distortion. You know, this, how would he do this? This is done, so you're familiar with Mercator projections of the globe. This is done by taking, you know, a spherical structure and, again, doing ray casting and projecting based to flatten out a curved structure. So there is distortion that happens, just like there's distortion of the continents when you do projections of the Earth onto a flat surface. There's distortions of the surface by projecting what it was, a tubular colon, onto a flat surface. But studies have been done to look at the accuracy of this for picking up polyps. For the task of picking up polyps, it's actually very sensitive. And as I said at the start, virtual colonoscopy, enough data has been acquired to show that this competes accurately with optical colonoscopy. So it's, I think it's poised to become an alternative for screening for colon cancer. It is good. It is working. So now I want to finish the rest of the time to talk about image interpretation, which is a little more of the work I'm personally involved with, which is we've produced these great displays of images, but we produce them in large volumes, and human beings need to consume them. So how can computers help people understand what they're seeing in the images? And there's two key ways, and they're called CAD. One, D, can either be diagnosis or detection. So computer-assisted detection is the task of, there's a signal, there's something in the image, I want to find it. You know, when you go through an airport security, they're doing a detection task. They're looking for the gun or the knife. And they don't have computer help yet, but, you know, you're looking for particular things, and the computer in large volume can help you find those things if it knows the typical things you're looking for. And the thing with detection is you don't want to miss anything, so the trade-off in sensitivity and specificity is such that, you know, if you want to pick up everything, you're going to pick up some false positives. So a radiologist does have to be in the loop to figure out, well, if the computer picks up something, is it real or is it something that, you know, is a false positive? So the radiologist has to interpret what the algorithm picks up. The related thing, D stands for diagnosis, is where it's not about picking up the abnormality. Suppose you pick it up. The next task is, well, what is it? Is it abnormal or is it normal and a normal variant or something to be ignored? So in CAD, for D diagnosis, we still leave it to the radiologist to detect what the abnormality is, but the computer can help the radiologist interpret, is that something I have to worry about? Is that a tumor or can I ignore it? Now, the two can be combined so that you have a fully computational system you know, but there still has to be a human being in the loop because, you know, you can't sue the computer and somebody has to make a decision whether the patient actually has a disease. So the detection task is really basically, you know, a Where's Waldo task. I mean, you know what the typical abnormalities are and you want to find the abnormality. So so there's Waldo. The equivalent in radiology is here. So anyone in the audience, where's the abnormality? And how do you know? Uh-huh. Where? Up, middle?
Yeah, up and then to the right.
Up and to the, you mean this side?
Yeah.
Toward here?
Yes.
No.
Okay, well.
This side's fine.
Yeah.
How about the other side?
Right, mid.
What clued you in?
What you're used to seeing.
Huh? Yeah, but I mean, what specifically are you seeing here in the right to the right hilum? You see this, okay.
And then another dark, brighter white border.
Right. Okay, oh no, this is normal. That part of the image is normal, but further to the right. Further to the right. Does anyone see anything?
Looks like there's a mass.
Ah, right here?
Yeah.
What clued you into that?
Well, I can actually see these white lines.
Ah, yes. Look for the radiologist arrows. Yes, absolutely. Very well-trained medical student. So that's exactly right. The detection task for medical students is look for the arrows the radiologist puts on the image. That's how you find the abnormalities. But the question is, okay, so who helps the radiologist draw the arrows in the first place? And so that's what CAD is about. So the radiologist does have abilities. They can see the abnormalities. But imagine reading 1,000 mammograms a day. You get fatigued, and you could, you know, detection, I said, it's all about sensitivity. You could miss things. So software has been created. These algorithms are trained. You know, they build a model. Well, what is the abnormality? A mass. How do you characterize a mass? Well, if you look at the pixels, a mass is homogeneous. It's dark or, you know, or white, and it has surrounded by a different color and whatever. So you can put all that algorithmically into a machine learning method that can then scan an image rapidly and put marks down according to what it's been trained to spot. And so the goal is to put flags to the radiologist to say, hey, well, look at this. You know, don't just pass on it. This might be something. And these are trained to be very, very sensitive, but not so specific, so there's a lot of false positives. And in mammography, this is a perfect fit for CAD because radiologists read tons of mammograms. They have to be very sensitive. You know, I could argue airports is another one. You know, you want to make sure you don't miss, let the person with the gun go through. But there could be a lot of false positives, and if anyone's ever gone through secondary screening, you know that's what that is about. So diagnosis is a related task, but we've already made the detection. So diagnosis is, you know, is it Waldo? We've picked something up. We don't know, is it Waldo? So that's Waldo. But, you know, it might be Waldo, but an atypical appearing Waldo. Or it might be something that looks like Waldo, but really is not Waldo. The equivalent in radiology is, you know, we have something that looks like this, and we have something that looks like this. And to the average eye, this and this look very, very similar. But in fact, this is a benign lymph node in the breast, and this is an infiltrating carcinoma in the breast. And how would you be clued in that, you know, this is Waldo, this is not Waldo? How do you know that that one is a normal structure and the other is abnormal? Well, if you scrutinize the image, you know, if it were a little darker, you'd see the margins of this are a little fuzzy and a little irregular, and it's not nicely circumscribed. And this has like a little kidney bean-like hilum with some fat, which is what lymph nodes look like. So those are, if you really scrutinize it, you know, you analyze the features, that clues you in. And that's kind of the main value that radiologists add, is recognizing those subtle features to figure that kind of thing out. But even the radiologist who's trained can make mistakes, and you can imagine having very complicated image-based models that have multiple factors to inform a radiologist as to what are all the features you need to consider to say, is it benign or malignant? And that's where the computer-assisted diagnosis comes in. So you might detect an abnormality. That's the perception task, and that's where CAD helps. But then you've got to interpret it and figure out, you know, what are the abnormalities that could produce that appearance. So that is where CAD-DX or diagnosis comes in. There's two other tasks, and that is once you've done the differential diagnosis, you've got to figure out, well, what are you going to do? And computers can help with that. That's called computer-assisted management. And then after you manage the patient, let's say biopsy them, and you get back a positive or negative result, you have to decide you can accept it because you could have sampling error. So that's called RAD-PATH correlation, and computer-assisted help for that is computer-assisted histopathologic correlation. All those things are called decision support. So that is the computer helping the physician use the knowledge in the image plus other knowledge outside the image to understand what's the diagnosis, what was the appropriate management, and was the outcome of doing that management appropriate. That's all data-intensive type of activity subject to variation according to different physicians and could benefit from computer support. Just to convince you that's the case, here's a study looking at mammography practice, looking at the ROC curves of 250 or so, 124 radiologists, plotting their false positive rate and their sensitivity. So this is showing that people are all over the map in terms of how sensitive and specific they are to the task of evaluating a mammogram and deciding whether to biopsy. I mean, ideally, you'd like to go to a practitioner who, when they call it positive, it's going to be positive all the time. But people are all over the map, unfortunately, in terms of how good they are at that task. And that's largely because they're not processing the information they're seeing in the image to come up with a management decision as effectively as they could. So the hypothesis is this computer support can help people make their decisions more consistently. Here's some work that we've done to use, in this case, a Bayesian model to say, okay, whatever you see, this is everything you can possibly see in a mammogram. They all relate to disease somehow through some probabilistic relationship. Given that you observed, you know, this and this and this, this model can calculate, you know, deterministically what's the probability of disease. So the model would be you read the mammogram and you enter the findings, what you see in the mammogram, into, like in this case, a structured reporting form recording what are the observations, and then you send that off to the Bayesian network and it returns, you know, a differential diagnosis list and saying that, you know, the probability of what you just saw in that image based on those observations is fibroadenoma with a probability of 0.97. So if your decision making is based on the probability of a malignant diagnosis and your cutoff for malignancy is, let's say, 2%, you know, you would not biopsy this particular person. So that is kind of how using computer-assisted decision support can help people more consistently make decisions and in conjunction with the patients. Because if a patient says, no, I want you to biopsy even if the chance is 1%, then you might decide to biopsy this person because they're within a 1% margin of error. And we've done some work to kind of look at does this really improve practice by comparing the radiologist's performance with the Bayesian network in a set of malignant and benign cases. And in fact, the Bayesian network does do a little bit better than the radiologist. But the important thing is the Bayesian network doesn't result in their missing any cancers, and it results in their biopsying fewer patients who've got benign disease. So I will just skip this and just talk a little bit about image reasoning in the last couple minutes, because to me this is the exciting stuff. You know, computerized image reasoning is all about helping the computer, having the computer help human beings, you know, make deductive conclusions from the mass of facts that include the images and the non-image data. And three examples are, you know, finding cases of particular diseases in large libraries, predicting the physiological consequences of abnormalities in the images, and guiding surgical planning. So the prerequisites for doing image reasoning is segmentation, ontologies, and semantic annotation, plus algorithms that actually do the reasoning. Anyone here heard of ontologies? Have you guys heard that word? One?
Mark gave a lecture in the fall.
Okay. Basically, you know, a computational way of representing the biomedical meaning in a domain. We basically say, what are the things that exist in our biomedical world? What are the things we work with when we're doing our experiments or looking at people? This is part of the Go, saying, well, we care about chromosomes and intracellular membrane-bound organelles, and, you know, chromosomes are part of those things, and you just kind of lay that out in a graph. That's what an ontology is, but it's a computational representation of the knowledge in the domain. So in radiology, for example, we're building ontologies to do the same thing, to say mucin and cystic neoplasms have synonyms, and they're related to cystic pancreatic neoplasms by Issa and that kind of thing. So we lay that out, and the next thing we do is we take the images, because the images themselves know nothing about what's in them. I mean, the image is just a two-dimensional matrix. It doesn't know there's a liver in there. You see, I told you radiologists draw on images, but, you know, those labels have no understanding or meaning to the computer. So semantic annotation is the process of providing a way of communicating, well, what is that meaning? When I draw a circle and say, you know, T-U-M-U-R, then I'm talking about there's a neoplasm at that point of the image. So we do that. And the final thing we do is we take the ontologies that represent the biomedical knowledge computationally, and we link it to the images, and then we do some computing that now combines the image itself with the knowledge that is not in the image, but now it's computable and connected to the image. And the way we might use that is, let's say you can't do this now, but we built a demo system to show this is perfectly doable. If you go to your PAC system, you can't query it and say, pull me back all of the cases of glioma. But in our test system, by combining the ontology with the image database, you could do that, because the oligoastrocytoma is a glioma, and we could pull out the oligoastrocytoma, and likewise for the astrocytoma and ependymal tumor, et cetera. So we're using the knowledge in the ontology to pull out the diagnoses from the image archive. Use case number two, let's say you've got a three-dimensional model that I showed you before, the person's shot. Question is, are they going to become hemodynamically stable in a very short period of time? How can you answer that question through an image reasoning task? You segment the image, identify the structure, so that is we can do. We superimpose the trajectory. We now take the anatomic knowledge and connect it to the image that I showed you before. And third, we take models of hemodynamics that tell us that, well, you know, if we've got the left ventricle and right ventricle, they're connected, and there's certain capacitances and resistance, we have a simulatable model which can be reconciled with the image itself, which is the source data, and we can run that model with the parameters that are driven by shape features and diameters, et cetera, and then predict, okay, when we run the simulation, how soon before a patient becomes hemodynamically unstable. And the final example before I let everyone go, surgical planning. You know, surgical planning is all about planning how should you transect particular structures to achieve particular outcomes. That's both an image-based anatomic task and a task that requires doing inference over functional knowledge. Again, we use this ontology-like paradigm, lay out what are all the structures, do certain things excite or inhibit other things, and we combine through links from the image to the model, and then say, okay, if that's the path of surgery, what is the net effect of activation or inhibition on the, in this case, target node, spinal cord? And in the future, we're going to be combining images with non-image data. Tool mentioned that up front, but I don't want to keep people over to talk about it, except to say that we're, you know, the final domain is to kind of relate, you know, what do we see at the molecular scale to what's going on in the images, and we can do that by also describing what's in those molecular data sets, relating it to what do we see in the images, and basically correlate things like, you know, molecular events with imaging type of events. Let me skip this and just wind up by summarizing. Images are a complex data type that the methods I showed you, I think, are going to be critical in our new e-science era with large volumes of images and non-image data, not only for image processing and visualization, but for this thing I call image reasoning, and mainly for, you know, doing data mining and discovery by combining what we see in the images with what we see in the patient or at the molecular level. And then I really think there'll be some future advances, but this intersection of imaging science and biomedical informatics. And I'm funded by NIH and CA Big, RSNA, and Akron, and thank you. Sorry to run quick. I believe in finishing in time. Yeah.
I'm just curious if the radiology community is welcome this or are resistant.
So that's actually a great question. So the answer is they welcome certain things and they resist certain things. And what's interesting is I think the things they tend to resist are things that is not unique to radiology, that people in internal medicine also resist. What do they accept? They accept the image processing and the volume rendering and the pretty pictures, because radiology is all about showing spectacular pictures. I mean, there's something about pretty pictures that draws an audience in. I was at a radiation oncology conference, and my wife, who's also a radiologist, showed one of those volume renderings of the pancreas with a tumor, and I swear, I've never heard this at a conference, but I heard, everyone just kind of went like that. I mean, so, you know, and yet, from an informatics point of view, you know, that visualization's so boring, because, you know, all it is doing ray casting and lookups in a table, and there's nothing, you know, computationally really fancy or, you know, but that's, you know, physicians love that. The decision support to me is what I think is critical, what I talked about at the end, of helping physicians, you know, process all this information and make good decisions that, you know, we hear these labels, personalized medicine, translational research. You know, what does that mean? What that really means is there's a lot of knowledge that the world has garnered together, and it's available, but only a small fraction of it is in the head of a physician who's taking care of a patient. I mean, how often do you just drop what you're doing and go to Google? Maybe you young people do this all the time, but a lot of the practicing radiologists, you know, they rely on what's in their head to in my experience, you probably heard this, you know, and the problem is you know that if you're not a medical person, you go to Google and you go and you instant message. I mean, you're in access to everything on the web. So likewise, we don't have that paradigm in medicine. We should be connecting, you know, our practice to the world's knowledge in the literature, in laboratories, whatever, to have the just-in-time best decision-making. And that, I think, people get, but it hasn't been, until it's been operationalized into products, I think that may be part of the hinder. Part of it also, I think, is sociological in terms of, you know, I don't want to be replaced by a computer. Clearly, radiologists have some concern with that, although the irony is that their greater threat is just distributing the images in a virtual world. They can lose their jobs from outsourcing the interpretations in India, and that has nothing to do with decision support or being replaced by a computer. So at the end of the day, I think what drives people is, you know, being enabled, having better capabilities, being able to, they respond to, hey, if this helps me reduce my variation and be more effective in terms of my positive predictive value, they'll embrace a tool like that, and that's at least my strategy, but it's a hypothesis. It needs to be demonstrated through use cases. Yeah. In particular use cases, yes. So in the brain, for surgical planning in the brain, that is, they are embracing these types of methods, especially if there's complexity. You know, if it's like, if I cut this, what's the downstream effect? So those kinds of, you know, propagation of effects is a case where you want to use those kinds of models to understand, make the complexity transparent to the users. And so they're definitely embracing it, again, for visualizing the relationships, but they're also getting very interested in understanding network effects. You know, if I make this disruption, what are the far-reaching network phenomena that can be disrupted? And so it's experimental still. I mean, it's not as though they've embraced this and changed their practice, but they're definitely receptive to it.
With the brain, are they doing it where they can actually detect for an individual person? Like, these are areas where if I caught here downstream, they're going to have these functional deficits. I mean, is it unique to people, individuals, or just you're mapping to a model and then this model?
You're mapping to, yeah, a human model.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Great. Well, thanks, everyone, and enjoy the rest of your pizza. Thank you, Phil.
Thanks for that broad introduction.
Yeah.